And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm honored to welcome Kate DiCamillo to the program today. She's one of America's most successful writers of children's literature, having won 2 Newbery medals, one for The Tale of Despero and the other for Flora and Ulysses. Her novels and chapter books for younger readers are perennial bestsellers. And her most recent novel, Ramey Nightingale, debuted at number 1 on the New York Times bestsellers list for children. Kate, Ramey Clark is the star of our story, and she wants to win a pageant. Which title is she after, and what's her unusual reason for wanting to win this one?
She's after the title Little Miss Central Florida Tyre. Ramey's 10 years old. Her father has left the family. She thinks if she wins, she'll get her picture in the paper, and her father will see her picture in the paper, and then he'll come home.
I was thinking about how kids kind of have this strange logic they operate under and how the things are like, but then I thought about myself and I said, well, you know, if I just get this pair of sneakers, I'll exercise more. I said, I still do it.
Yeah, magical thinking. Yeah. This kid, Ramey Clark, is very much the kind of kid that I was. And you exist as a kid, or I did, in a perpetual state of hope and also thinking there's got to be some way to take action. And it might not always be an action that makes sense to an adult, but to her, it's a very logical sequence of events. She will win. He will come home.
And she's, of course, trying to make sense of the world.
Right.
And, I mean, that's a difficult process.
Right. And, I mean, we're still doing it as adults, right? It's a lifetime project to try to make sense out of this world.
I like that she often gauge her current sense on how inflated her soul was.
Right. And this is, again, another thing that I remember very clearly from being a kid was that preoccupation with my soul and whether or not I was being good, because that's something else that Ramey has to do for the Little Miss Central Florida Tyre contest is she has to perform good deeds. And those good deeds are also connected with her soul and whether it feels large and billowing out like a tent or hard and small like a marble.
As you mentioned, Ramey's 10 years old, and quite often in your standalone books, the protagonists are 10 years old. It seems like, except maybe for one book, maybe?
Oh, yeah, you've done due diligence. Yes, that's exactly right.
So what is it about the 10-year-olds?
I don't know. I remember the very first time I did an interview, because Winn-Dixie was my first book, and the interviewer said, so, tell me, how do you get into the mind of a 10-year-old child? And I was so gobstopped by the question because to me, it was so clear. The answer was so clear, but I was a 10-year-old kid. And I think that for me, that is just maybe more on the surface than it is for other people. Beverly Cleary, you know, turned 100 maybe like a month ago. And I heard her say in an interview that all those memories are right on the surface of being a child, are right there for her, and that has been really beneficial to her. She can just access them. So I think there's a part of me that is just still 10, and I've learned that that might be a good thing and not something to be apologetic about.
Also, it's such a big happening for a child to hit 10. You're now double digits. You've been single digits all your life.
Right.
You're double. And if you're lucky, you're going to be double digits for a long, long time before you get to go up to triple digits.
Right, right. It's the double digit thing. And it's also a thing of thinking that, and I think this is particularly true for Ramey, you're going to understand something. You know, the older you get, the more you're going to understand things. That goes along with her preoccupation with the soul. She has these moments where, like when she's in the nursing home and the floor has been buffed to such a high sheen and it looks like a lake, it's glowing, and she has this feeling like, I'm going to understand everything. It's all going to make sense. And then those feelings don't really pan out for her, and she doesn't understand everything. But I think that, you know, as a kid, you think the older you get, the more you're going to understand. I don't know. Do you think that ultimately that pans out? Do you understand more now than you did when you were 10?
Some things, not others.
Uh-huh. Right, right.
Everything's situational, it seems. Now, the story is set in the mid-70s in Florida, and this is really familiar territory for you.
Yes, it sure is. My family moved to Central Florida from Philadelphia in 1969 when I was 5 years old. And so I grew up in a small town in Central Florida in the mid 70s. So while this book is not autobiography, it has a few very potent autobiographical elements.
And you share them with several of the characters in the story, I can see.
I do.
And I read that good authors put a bit of themselves in all of their characters.
Right, and I certainly don't do it wittingly. It's an unwitting thing. I mean, I think it's impossible to write anything without revealing something of yourself, and that is particularly true with these characters. Raimi is the one that bears the most resemblance to me, but I am there in those other girls as well. So there are two other girls that are in the book, Louisiana Elefante and Beverly Topinski. And they're pieces of work, as my mother would have said.
There's a lot of pieces of work in the book. And Louisiana Elefante, you share swampy lungs with.
Wow. You are the first person to point that out. That is exactly right. That is spot on. And that's why we moved to Florida in 1969, because of my swampy lungs. I got pneumonia for 3 winters in a row in Philadelphia, and it was still a time when geographical cures were prescribed. So they said move to Florida or Arizona. And we moved to Florida, me and my swampy lungs.
Did all that humidity down there do anything for it?
Well, I didn't get pneumonia again.
Good for that.
Yeah, but I was just a professional at having all kinds of diseases when I was a kid. And, you know, you read these interviews. There are a lot of writers who had sickly childhoods. And sometimes I think, what if I hadn't been sick so much? I wonder if I would be a writer. Because I spent so much time alone. You learn to live in your head, and you learn to live in books.
So when you moved up to Minneapolis later in your life, did you manage to stay clear of pneumonia?
I did. It's funny because I was just talking to a group of kids when I was in Nashville and talking about that whole progression. And usually the kids don't put that together. It's like, why did you go from Florida to Minnesota if you had this lung problem? And I think, and I don't know, we would have to get a medical professional on board, but they don't think it has anything to do with cold anymore. And as I said to the kid, that's how old I am. It's like, but they still thought it was geographical. Yeah,
I'll commiserate with you. That's how old we are.
That's how old we are together. I'm proud of it, man.
Now, the book starts off, Raimi is at a baton twirling class, and her teacher is one Miss Ida Nee. Mm-hmm. And as talented as she is in twirling, she is untalented in having patience with her charges.
She doesn't have a lot of talent in the human interaction realm. Yeah, Ida Nee does not. And Ida Nee, we don't ever really see full evidence of it, but I think, and I know her pretty well, that she's a genius at twirling, but I don't know that it translates into the rest of her life. She has no patience with these girls.
So which part of you is an Ida Nee?
You know, that's a good question. And I would have to say that there's nothing of me in Ida Nee except for the child who is looking at Ida Nee. Because I was a kid who, you know, I had to think real carefully when somebody said move left or move right, you know. So I have some kind of spatial intelligence issue. And so the Ida Nees of the world had very little patience for me as I stood there with my mouth open trying to twirl the baton or hit the tennis ball or move left or right.
Did you hear the phrase a lot when your kid, no, your other left?
I sure did. I mean, like in the doctor's office, another place that I was all the time, I would have to think sometimes when he said, I'm sitting on the examining table, okay, lay down on your stomach. And I'd have to go, okay, my stomach. Yeah. Yeah. I'm challenged in that way.
So when you're writing and imagining your characters moving around in their space, does that difficulty play into that at all?
That's a brilliant question. It does not at all. And I see it very clearly in my mind. And I don't have any problem moving through that made-up space. Yeah. That other world.
You mentioned Louisiana Elefante earlier, and she reveals that she's entering the same pageant, but she has different reasons for wanting to win.
Yeah, Louisiana lives with her grandmother. And speaking, we were saying earlier about words that I know on the page that I don't know that I could pronounce, but I know the word. I'm going to spell it and you can say it, okay? She lives with her grandmother in P-E-N-U-R-Y.
Penury?
Yeah, I don't know because I've only ever read it. I haven't heard it said. But they are scraping by. Louisiana's parents are, as far as we know, dead. Louisiana says that they were famous trapeze artists called the Flying Elefantes. And so it's just Louisiana and her grandmother. And the Little Miss Central Florida Tire Contest has a very large purse attached. It's $1,975.
Matches the year.
Yeah, 1975. So Louisiana needs to win so that they can eat. Also, she's very interested in getting her cat back because they couldn't afford to feed the cat anymore, Archie, and have taken him to the very friendly animal center.
And he's our kind of in absentia animal presence for the book.
Right, because I can't do without an animal, can I? I am like, here I am writing along, and I'm thinking, well, I'm writing a book without an animal, but no, I'm not.
And it's such a poignant repeating phrase that comes to the book, I'm sorry I betrayed you.
Yeah. It's funny because I was reading aloud from it last night at an event, and I read that because, you know, you always start at the beginning, and that's right there in the beginning. Because I never know what anything means in a book that I write. And I thought, I wonder if that's kind of like what Raimi needs, you know, to hear from her father. And that's why it matters so much to her. I don't know. I'll let the critics tell me what it means.
And Louisiana's grandmother is a character. She's a piece of work herself.
Yes, she
and
is.
In my mind, I had Ruth Gordon from Harold and Maude.
Yes, that would be brilliant. Louisiana's grandmother is the daughter of a magician, she says, the most elegant and deceitful man who ever lived.
So does this magician have any connection to any of your other works?
You really have done your homework, yeah. I have a small obsession with magicians, and there's a magician and the magician's elephant, a magician who isn't a very good magician and then does something wondrous and it kind of blows up in his face. So Louisiana's grandmother also is not a good driver. And I don't know if I actually, you know, you go through the editing process. I don't know if this ended up in there or not, but at one point Raimi's in the car and Louisiana's grandmother is driving as Louisiana's grandmother does. And Raimi thinks, or I thought it was kind of like being on Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. You remember that from the Magic Kingdom? So she's a crazy driver.
And it's not exactly all her fault. She can't see over the dashboard.
No, she's so small that it looks like, what is it, Raimi thinks that it looks like a headless horseman, except it's a headless station wagon. You can't see anybody behind the wheel.
Probably just a set of white knuckles on top of the wheel. You also mentioned Beverly Tupinski, and she's rather fond of telling people that her father is a police officer.
Right. Beverly Tupinski is, you know, not that we need to keep on repeating ourselves, but she's another piece of work. So her father is a police officer in New York City, so she says. She plans to sabotage the Little Miss Central Florida Tire Contest. She's one of those kids who's been pushed into a lot of these contests by her mother, who was a beauty queen. So Beverly's very angry and has no interest in any Little Miss contest with spangly outfits or anything like that.
The irony is she's the most talented of the lot.
She twirls a baton and makes it look easy and impossible at the same time.
So yeah. Like Ida Nee, she has this talent, but she lacks others, and hers is emotional vulnerability.
Right? She is a tough, tough cookie, but one of the moments that haunts me the most in the book is when she does this. That means not really a spoiler if I say it. They're in a nursing home, and for various and assorted reasons, and there's a woman who keeps screaming, take my hand, and the kids are terrified of her, and Beverly takes her hand. Sits down next to her and hums, is very gentle with her. And it's not what you anticipate from this character at all. And I think that maybe that's part of what the book is about, too. These things that are hidden inside of us that we don't even know are there. Because that's the case with Raimi at the end. She doesn't know what she's capable of. And she finds out that she can do wondrous things.
And also Beverly has the best line I've read in the past year. I don't wish, I sabotage.
See, I shouldn't laugh so much, but it's not like I said it. It's Beverly said it. Yeah. No, I love Beverly. I love them all, I have to say.
And with the scenes in the nursing home and then later with an animal shelter, we'd kind of see how at odds these young girls' mindsets are opposed to how society treats the least of us.
Well, and this goes back to me not knowing what I'm doing until critics pointed out to me. And I just had somebody point that out either in an interview or I can't remember a review, how the nursing home and the very friendly Animal Center, or Building 10, as it's better known, mirror each other in this thing that is so distressing to kids that never really gets talked about where you get shoved if you're not useful or beautiful.
You mentioned Raimi needs good deeds, and that's how she ends up at the Golden Glen Nursing Home.
Yeah.
To read to the residents. And she was encouraged to do that by Mrs. Sylvester, who's kind of her guide into the pageant. That's her father's secretary.
Mm-hmm.
And she strikes me as someone who's nice, but is mostly kind of just a collection of platitudes walking.
And a little bit worried. I think Mrs. Sylvester is a little bit worried that things will go off the rails at any given time. She's very interested in the rails and doesn't want to know what happens off the rails. And things are off the rails in Raimi's life. She takes a lot of comfort from Mrs. Sylvester because she can call, Raimi can call her father's office and Mrs. Sylvester will answer the phone. Jim Clark, Family Insurance, how may we protect you?
And he's going to have to change the name of that business.
Yeah. But Raimi takes a lot of comfort from that phrase. How may we protect you? To think that somebody can protect you.
And often she'll call and just be silent for moments.
Right. Just to hear that.
And
yeah.
Mrs. Sylvester will be patient with her.
Right. And her little cartoon voice. Mrs. Sylvester has a really high voice. I'd like to be in a... There are so many wonderful teachers who read aloud from my books in their classrooms. I would like to hear them do Mrs. Sylvester's voice. I think it would be kind of like this.
Well, it's a good thing you didn't give her kind of a very liquidy Sylvester the cat type of effect. The book that she has chosen to take with her to the nursing home is a book that Mr. Option, the school librarian, has given to her. Why does he think that Florence Nightingale might be an interesting topic for...
Raimi really likes this librarian, and she trusts him. Raimi likes to read stories. She doesn't like to read nonfiction. And at the end of the school year, Edward Option says to her, why don't you take this biography? It would be good for you to read some nonfiction. And she only does it because she wants to please Edward Option, who she likes so much. And I don't know what Edward Option is thinking, but it's this thing where there are people who come along and can see things in you that you don't know are there. And I think that's what it is. He sees something in her that she does not know is there. And I won't give anything away, but he's right. It's there.
He's one of two male characters we get to see in the course of the story.
Off stage, both of them.
Yes.
Somebody just pointed this out to me the other day, too. There are no male characters on stage. They're off stage.
They're all kind of flashbacks to him.
Yeah.
We had Mr. Stephopoulos.
Yeah.
Who ran the life-saving course.
Yeah.
And, of course, he left as well, so we have all these fathers leaving.
Right, right. Yeah. I sound like a very disturbed individual, don't I?
No, but it sounds like there's a theme that you like to investigate.
And, you know, that goes back to the autobiographical element, you know, my father leaving when we made that move to Florida, and he didn't make the move too. And so it's the kind of thing that as a kid, no one can ever answer it to your satisfaction. And as a kid, you always feel somewhat responsible.
If that's anything we could give to our kids and the kids of the future, is to let them know that the world isn't their fault.
Boy, wouldn't that be great? I don't think that I was alone or am alone in that thought as a kid that I should fix it somehow. That's one of the great things about books and stories, is that you can have that discussion with the kid and say, it's not on you to fix it, you know?
You didn't break it.
You didn't break it, yeah.
Now, you know, while we're down on the fathers, because we have a lot of fathers leaving the families one way or another, whether it be imprudent enough to drown in the ocean.
Right, the elefantes.
But the mothers really don't acquit themselves too well in the stories either, because Beverly's mother is not helpful at all. And
nope, and angry.
And Raimi's mother is, of course, very upset that her husband has just left
the
family.
She's stunned.
And she's not of much use to Raimi.
But there are people who are. And one of them is Mrs. Borkowski, who's the elderly neighbor who sits out in the middle of the street in her lawn chair. Raimi feels like she can ask Mrs. Borkowski anything. The answer that she gets might not necessarily be illuminating, but she has the freedom to ask this adult anything that she wants to ask her. And then at the end, and I think I'm trying to think if I can talk about this without giving anything away, Ruthie... when a nurse shows up and says some words.
He's a skunk.
That Raimi's been waiting to hear without even knowing that she needed to hear it. Yeah.
Should I take that out?
No, no. You don't have to take that out. But it moved me to hear you say it, you know. So I must have needed to hear those words as a kid, too. And no one ever says them. That's not what you say.
Well, could you do me a favor and pronounce P-H-H-H-T-T-T for me?
I've been called to do this a couple times now, and it surprises me. I didn't. You never know what's going to happen to you when you go out into the world with a book, but I didn't think it was going to be this. This is what Mrs. Borkowski says, and I say it like this. It's very dismissive. Yeah.
I wrote in the margins, derisive sound?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Because I was thinking about all the kind of non-spellable expressions that we have. I remember someone telling me that the French tend to roll their lips real hard when they go, and in Germany, kind of a surprise in one way or another is, ach,
ach,
ach, ach. I was just trying to think of all the weird little verbal tics we have.
But we have them, and they don't always end up in a book because then you don't know how to say, but you can say it any way you want, right? It's just that some noise to make in the face of how impenetrable human existence is sometimes.
Given so much of our existence isn't dealing with words, I guess we think somewhat in words. It's a huge challenge to kind of then translate that onto the page.
Right. And it's funny because it's like, in a way, though, it's not, because I find these characters, I just have to like get out of my own way and let them, they give me the words or the fts or the, you know, it's just like it's tapping into those characters. I never knew what was going to come out of Beverly Tepinski's mouth. And I never knew what was going to come out of Louisiana's mouth. That's always the place that I hope to be as a writer, not knowing and them being in charge.
So tell me, why does the world exist?
You do a really good Mrs. Borkowski, I have to say. And I don't know, but I think that story is one of the best places to ask that question.
The story you tell is in third person. It's close with, it follows Raimi all the way through.
Super close third.
And it's not omniscient, so we don't know what everybody else is thinking at any given moment. Why did you choose that instead of a first person?
I don't know. It's very rare that I make conscious kind of decisions. I mean, I tried for a long time to find my way into this, and the problem was not writing it, but the fact that every sentence of it that I touched had 20 sentences underneath. It was just like the longest manuscript, and I never once thought about going to first person. And I think that even though a couple of people have thought that it's first person because it's so close third, but it gives you just a tiny bit more control if you're in third, because then I can let you know what Raimi's thinking in a way that doesn't seem disingenuous, because a 10-year-old wouldn't necessarily have the words for some of what she's going through. And with that little bit of distance of third, I can tell you some of the complicated stuff that's in her soul.
So are you the third person in this case, or who is telling us the story?
That's another really good question. And I would say it's the adult me. The adult Raimi is telling the story.
Raimi is your first standalone novel since your second Newbery winner, Flora and Ulysses. When you're approaching a standalone as opposed to books that might be part of a series, do you feel a difference while you're writing it?
I don't. And all of the things that have been part of a series for me have been significantly shorter works. So they're not novels. So what I always feel is that a novel, and they've all been standalone novels for me, it's like a big meal. And the shorter series things are like sorbet. They're like something, a lighter entertainment in between all the heavy courses of a big meal. So it's just a huge commitment to enter into that world and to wrestle all those people. And because I never know where a story is going to end up or what's going to happen. And there's so many pages to find my way through. It's scarier. That's probably the biggest thing. It's scarier.
You talked about how long the manuscript was before. You must be very, hopefully you're confident in when you're editing that down.
That's nice of you. Yeah.
Well, I don't want you to suffer. when he's in person.
Too late.
But it seems like quite of a challenge to make everything more implied than explicit as much as possible.
You know, it's funny because I have all the, I print up draft after draft, and they all go into a collection at the University of Minnesota called the Curlin. But I never really go back and look at them. But I know that something critical happened with a friend of mine who's a writer and a teacher, and I couldn't condense it. I couldn't make it quite work. I knew I had something, but I had her read, and she just stripped things down a little bit. She only did it with a couple pages, and it was all I needed. And then everything kind of like cleared away, and I could see what it was I needed to do. So that it's kind of like you said, hopefully the one word that's there implies the 10 words that aren't.
So you've been honored many times in your career, but most recently as an ambassador for Young Readers Literature. What's that experience been like for you?
It was something that I was very intimidated to do in the beginning, not the least of which because it involved going to the Library of Congress in a dress and getting a medal to start it off with. And then it just seemed, you know, it's a big title.
You get the medal at the end of your career?
Yeah, I know. No, you get the medal before it, I guess, to give you courage to go out and do it. But it's one of those things where it was a fabulous experience for me because I would say a quarter of the way through it, it's a 2-year term, I really settled into it and thought, but this is what I want to do, is just go around and remind people about the privilege and the joy and the power of reading together. So it was a great experience.
Do you think it slowed down your writing a little bit, having those responsibilities, or did it fit right in?
It actually turned out to be a nice balance in many ways. Raimi's story is the result of having done that ambassadorship because I have a PowerPoint that I do with kids where I talk about, you know, this is how I became a writer, and here I am as a kid, and here I am sick as a kid, and here I am with my mother and my brother as a kid, and who's missing in this photograph, and talking just bluntly about the fact that my father left. And I think that that's where this book came from. I also, the small town that I grew up in, Claremont, had a tower called the Citrus Tower where you could go up and look out over the world. And that's in that PowerPoint, too. And there's a tower here. So.
And that's where Beverly's mother works.
Yeah.
So when you started writing because of Winn-Dixie, probably a little less than 20 years ago, did you think having PowerPoint presentations was part of the life of the author?
Well, one, let's just start with the word author because, you know, I was working at a book warehouse that served as a distributed books to all the upper Midwest bookstores and libraries. And so when I sold the manuscript for Winn-Dixie, I had very realistic expectations about what would happen to me as somebody who had written a middle grade novel. I thought if I was really lucky, I would sell 5,000 copies and that the rest would be remaindered in some country where I did not have to see them, you know. And so what happened with Winn-Dixie, it was bigger than any dream I could ever have. And so then I did start going around and talking to schools. There wasn't PowerPoint then at that point, nor did I have a presentation. I just stood up there and talked with the kids, and I did that for a long time, right up until the ambassadorship. That was when I finally got a PowerPoint. Make myself look professional.
And I just have one last question for you.
All right.
One has three legs, no arms, and reads the paper all day long.
is the answer on the bottom of a cup, or is it a cup with no answer? Is it a riddle with no answer? Okay, so it's three legs.
No arms. And reads the paper all day long.
I don't know. What's the answer?
I don't know. It was in your book. I was reading. I'm going, I worked on it for about 2 minutes. I went,
I've never been good at riddles, so I didn't feel like I had to, like, come up with one that I could answer. As long as it stumped me, I thought I was fine. Yeah.
Well, and your role as a writer is to raise questions. You're not given any answers.
Yeah, no, I'm not. Although sometimes I find some answers as I write, and that's the beauty of writing, I think.
Well, Kate, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today and sharing Raimi Nightingale with us.
Well, thank you for reading Raimi Nightingale and for talking to me.
Kate DiCamillo is the author of Raimi Nightingale, which is published by Candlewick. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.